Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. We need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers, and we welcome your calls from out across the nation at 1-888-24-LIBERTY, here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But we ask that you hold your calls for the time being, because we have with us Michael Springman, and Michael's got an amazing, amazing story to tell, and we'd actually read his story elsewhere, and I just wanted to share it with you. He used to work in the, I assume it was the embassy over in Saudi Arabia, and he was in charge of course, giving visas to people. So I'm going to let him more or less tell the story of what happened when he was over there. What was it like living over in the Middle East?
Well, it was kind of like life in a gilded cage.
In other words, you couldn't get out to, and around too much? And
well, you could get all sorts of things, but then there are things you couldn't possibly get. For example, you could get expensive cars, expensive clothes, expensive electronics goods, but you couldn't get movies, you couldn't get radio or television that didn't have anything other than constant prayers or old American movies about firefighters in the Midwest.
I see. So they were pretty strict as far as to what they allowed into the country.
Exactly.
How long were you actually there? Were you actually working in the embassy?
I was at the consulate in Jeddah, the principal city in the western province of Saudi Arabia.
All right, fine. And so you were then, your job was to actually issue visas to people.
Exactly. They were applications to enter the United States, and I personally interviewed or looked through the applications of, I guess, about 40,000 people in the year and a half I was there.
All right, fine. Now, of course, what were your specifications for having people come into America? Could anybody come into America?
No.
Could they have to have a reason to come in?
Exactly.
Or what would give you a sort of a red light when you talk to somebody about coming to America?
Well, the way the Immigration and Nationality Act is worded, you have to demonstrate that you are going to the United States for a specific purpose, and when this purpose is over, you will return to either your home country or your place of application. And by and large, the people that I dealt with either could demonstrate that they would do this, or they couldn't, and they generally talked themselves out of a visa in the space of about 2 minutes.
All right, fine. So they had to have a reason to come here. Now, were there any limitations placed on the number of people who would come from Saudi Arabia to the United States?
No.
In other words, they could, as many people as they wanted, as long as they had a reason to come.
Exactly. I mean, the immigration is another story, but to come for business or pleasure or to study in the United States, you had to demonstrate that you were going to school, that you had been accepted at a school, somebody would pay for the school, and that the course of study was for a specific purpose and for a specific length.
All right, fine. And, of course, if you found somebody that didn't fit into that category, why, they just didn't get a visa.
Exactly.
But what happened to you? You began to find that increasingly why people that you didn't think should be given visas were being given visas?
Exactly. Before I left Washington, the American ambassador, Walter Cutler, had spent about 40 minutes with me talking in a very elliptical and rather peculiar fashion, excuse me, about problems with visas at Jeddah. And I had no idea what he was talking about or why he was talking about it. But when I got there, I found out. I would get people that were clearly intending immigrants, that they would go to the United States and never come back. These were people who had been in the country, you know, less than 6 months, who had low-level jobs like the King's Secretary's Barber. He wanted a visa to come to America. There were a couple of Pakistanis who said they were going to a trade show in the United States, but couldn't name the trade show and couldn't name the city in which it was going to be held.
All right, so you were immediately suspicious of him.
Exactly, and I would say no. You know, I'd ask him questions. What are you doing? Why are you going? Where are you going? How long have you worked here, et cetera? And when I didn't get any real coherent answers, I'd refuse the visa. And then I get a call from the consul general, or I would get a call from, in the case of the Pakistanis, the CIA case officer concealed in the commercial section, to reverse my decision.
Well, now, wait a minute. Why would the CIA want you to issue visas to people who shouldn't be coming to America?
Well, that's what I wondered myself. And initially, I thought this was plain out-and-out visa fraud. Somebody was paying some money off there. And once I come back to Washington and once I was out of the Foreign Service, I ran across a fellow who worked for a local university and another guy who had worked for a U.S. government agency and ran across a well-connected journalist. And they all three told me essentially the same story. What I had been doing was challenging that visa fraud, but people who were coming to the United States, who had been recruited by the CIA and its then asset Osama bin Laden, and they were coming here for terrorist training.
Really? I mean, this is what you were told, actually, by people who'd been looking into this?
Yeah, well, they weren't looking into it. They were involved with it. They were well-connected in the Middle East.
And so basically what you were doing by not letting the people come in was, of course, cutting off access of these people coming to America for terrorist training, right?
Right, right. The idea was to send them to America, train them, and then send them back to Afghanistan to make trouble for the then-Soviet army.
Now, what year was this that you're talking about?
This was 1987 to 1989, about the time the war in Afghanistan was winding down.
Well, I think that most people do not know that we were actually training the Al-Qaeda here. At that time, or we were training the Mujahideen here in the United States for the war. Is that the case?
Well, the Mujahideen were pretty much sourced from just about everywhere, from Palestine, from Syria, from Saudi Arabia and Pakistan and other places, and they became the Al-Qaeda people later on.
So we were actually training these people who now are the Al-Qaeda that we're fighting against.
Exactly. The people in the Middle East, the Syrians, the Lebanese, the Saudis, the Jordanians, they wouldn't let these characters back into their country. They were recruited, they were shipped off to Afghanistan, and when it came time for them to come home, people said, uh-oh, these guys have learned some skills that are not in everybody's abilities, and suppose they decide to do here in our country what they've been doing in Afghanistan.
All right, we're going to have to interrupt you for just a couple of minutes, and this is the time when I have to tell our listeners out across America that we really are listener-supported, and one thing you can do to help us is to change your long-distance carrier over to Promise Vision. And you do that, of course, by calling their number and just saying that you heard about them through us. You call 866-448-5631. That's 866-448-5631. Their prices are very, very competitive. It doesn't cost anything to change over, although they do have some special deals now, and I'm going to take one of them myself, where, of course, we can get the price of our long-distance calls down to about 5.5 cents a minute anywhere in the country, which is really a pretty good deal. But be that as it may, we hope that you'll call, that you'll give serious consideration to changing your long-distance carrier over there, and then 15% of whatever your long-distance bill is will come back to Radio Liberty and help us do what we do. And then, of course, we want to mention that we carry the Phonixopoly or Phonopoly programs. It is a board game. It's actually 5 board games and 2 bonus games that will teach children how to read phonetically, pronounce words phonetically, and spell phonetically, and they're available by calling 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. Most of these programs that teach children to read phonetically are going to cost you in the neighborhood of $300 or $400. This is $139.95. And of course, you not only get the 5 board games, the 2 bonus games, you get a couple of books along with that that explains there's been an organized effort to dumb down the American people, which is why our scores, our SAT scores, are so low today.
A very important book is called AIDS, The Unnecessary Epidemic. Actually, it's a book I wrote back in 1991 that tells you the story of the politics of the AIDS epidemic and the fact that doctors have been blocked at every turn from doing what was really necessary to stop the spread of this horrible plague, both in the United States and throughout the world. AIDS, The Unnecessary Epidemic, it gives you my story of my effort working with an organized medicine, the fact that the doctors of the state of California consistently voted and supported an effective public health policy, and at every turn their efforts were frustrated by those working with an organized medicine, both at the state and national level, and the tragedy is that people are dying in America today unnecessarily. Call 1-800-5-HIV-WAR and ask for AIDS, The Unnecessary Epidemic, because you need to understand the background of this epidemic to understand what is really happening medically in America today.
Well, Dr. Stan, here at Radio Liberty, our guest is Mr. Springman, Michael Springman, and of course he worked there in the visa section at the consulate in Zeta. And of course, he was trying to do his job well. Do you think that the man who briefed you before you went to Jedham and was talking sort of obliquely was telling you to go ahead and simply issue all the passports? What was he trying to tell you? Or do you have any idea?
Yeah, I think it was pretty much go along and do whatever they tell you to do.
Don't rock the boat, you know, don't obey the law. Just, if you stay there, why, you'll get ahead there.
I think if they had told me what they were doing at the beginning, I was dumb enough at that time to have said, sure, I'll cooperate. But they didn't, and since my name was on the visa plate, and it was me that would go to jail or be fined or both, for letting these characters slide through, I thought it was best thing to do for my career was to say no to these characters.
All right, and of course that eventually your career then ended.
Yes, indeed.
Yeah, right.
They threatened me repeatedly with, if you want to keep working for the State Department, you'll issue these visas. And eventually they yanked my appointment.
All right. Now, of course, you actually were getting calls then from the Central Intelligence Agency suggesting you violate the law and let these people in. They didn't work quite that crass, I suppose, but
no.
The inference was there.
Well, it was there. It came mainly from people who supposedly worked for the Department of State, the Consul General, and I complained to the chief of the consular section. I complained to him. I complained to the Counselor for Consular Affairs in Riyadh, and when they had a State Department inspection team come out to make sure the consulate was following proper governmental policies, they came and wanted to talk to me about this. They apparently knew all about it, and I had been told by a contact that if you talk about this, it's the end of the road in the State Department.
In other words, you were told not to tell the people who were coming to investigate.
Yeah. And the guy who told me this, I thought, eventually worked for the agency.
You know, I think he was a Central Intelligence Agency.
Yeah.
All right, fine.
And the next thing I know, the guy, you know, he spent an hour working on me, telling me that, you know, you will be protected. He told me everything I knew, plus a little bit more, and he finally wore me down enough to confirm everything he had told me. And the next thing I knew, he had gone to the administrative officer, who had then gone to the consul general, and then I had a horrible fitness report.
All right. Now, I think that our listeners out there have to understand that it was during this era and even up into the 1990s, after the war ended, that the Central Intelligence Agency was funding the Al-Qaeda movement. First of all, we called them the Mujahideen, but by 1985, they were the Al-Qaeda. And then, of course, there was over in Egypt a man named Sheikh Omar Rahman, and he was an agitator. He was the blind sheikh. And he was, of course, trying to overthrow the Egyptian government, and he got arrested a couple of times. And each time he would get out of jail under very, very mysterious circumstances, almost as if there was an invisible force that was behind him. And there's a fascinating book called Unholy Wars, written by James Cooley, who's a writer for the Christian Science Monitor, certainly no right-wing extremist. And he points out that the suspicion was that the CIA was using Sheikh Omar Rahman. And then, of course, Sheikh Omar Rahman, who is known to be an advocate of terrorism, gets a visa to come to the United States. and he goes to New York City, and he begins agitating among the Arabs, the Muslims there, to blow up the World Trade Center and blow up a lot of other things. And it is his followers, along with, of course, a lot of encouragement, one of the FBI agent, Mr. Salem, who is planted in their midst, who keeps talking about blowing up things that eventually leads to the bombing of the World Trade Center in February of 1993. But nobody ever asks why Sheikh Omar Rahman, who was a known terrorist and advocating terrorism, was brought to America. People just don't ask that question. Well, here you are seeing this from the other point of view. You're seeing it over in Saudi Arabia. And you think that these were primarily Mujahideen who were being brought over here for terrorist training? What is your take on it looking back at this now?
Well, a lot of them were. A lot of them, I think, or a number of them, were brought over as rewards or for information or kind of an indoctrination, maybe. I know, for example, that the good Sheikh, he got his visa in the Sudan.
Who was that now?
That was this Rahman guy.
All right, fine.
He got his visa from a CIA case officer who was concealed in the consular section. And his argument was, well, gee, the automated system was down that day, and I didn't see this guy's name on the list, so he got the visa.
Right.
But you don't
really believe that, do you?
Pardon?
You don't really believe that?
No, not at all.
All right.
Although the CIA, I was told by an experienced consular officer, often did not put all the people it knew about into the system.
All right.
For purposes.
And so we were bringing known terrorists here to the United States.
Yeah. And, you know, the way they would work it, I mean, the base chief at Jeddah came to me one day and said, look, I've got an Iranian contact. He's got a green card. He wants to go to the States. You know, interview him and make it look good. We're going to bring him over for our own purposes. We want to talk to him at Langley and make it look good, fella. So the guy comes up to the visa window. He's been to the States before. He has a rug shop in town. He has a legitimate purpose for going. I didn't need to question him severely about the visa. You know, he was a good prospect.
All right, so you let him through, but he, of course, you were told, in essence, to do
it. But even if I hadn't been told, I would have issued the visa anyway.
Right.
And I would imagine there were a number of other cases that had clean passports, clean backgrounds, and a believable cover story, and they probably got visas as well.
All right, fine. Well, of course, go ahead.
Well, I kept a list of a file folder of people that were questionable that I had been ordered to give visas to. And when I had told the inspection team about this, I found once I'd left the country that this file folder had been shredded.
I see. Well, now, what was the response of this inspection team when you told them the truth, that you were being encouraged to give visas to people who shouldn't be getting visas?
Well, they didn't really say anything one way or the other. It was basically, okay, fine. But when I brought the issue to the Bureau of Consular Affairs, as I had been advised to do, and when I talked with the Inspector General's office and with the Diplomatic Security Office at the State Department and with the Government Accounting Office, I was basically ignored and told it was all imaginary, that it was a matter of opinion whether or not these people should have gotten visas. And I was flabbergasted, because if there's anything the State Department is concerned about, is somebody engaging in visa fraud and issuing visas when they shouldn't.
Now, do you think that there are several components in the State Department? One component that wants to do the good job and wants to do it according to the book, and then there are other people who have another agenda?
Oh, yeah, definitely. I mean, aside from the usual people at the State Department who get excited only when their own ox is being gored, there are the people who don't work for the State Department. The general view is, according to a former station chief and a former member of the Inspector General's office, roughly one-third of the people who say they work for the State Department don't.
In other words, they are intelligence operatives.
Yeah. Sure. For example, in the Bureau of Intelligence and Research at the State Department, 10% of the 300 positions there are reserved for the agency.
And I think that the people really have to understand that we have, within the structure of our government, mm-hmm. an invisible government.
Oh, yeah.
And it has a different agenda. It answers really to not to any of our elected representatives. I mean, occasionally when they'll have a congressional investigation, the truth will come out. They find out they've been killing people, and they did kill people. They killed several national, international leaders and other people, other countries. Of course, they made it illegal after that, but that really didn't stop anything, because I've talked to people who were paid as late as 1988, 1989 to be assassins for Central Intelligence Agency, and that's total violation of the law. But then, of course, who's going to enforce the law? The CIA. In fact, recently we were going to have a Senate intelligence investigation of what happened on September 11th to find out why the CIA, did not, provide the information, or the FBI, and who did they put in charge of that investigation? Why, somebody from the CIA.
Yeah.
And, of course, it's sort of like the Warren Commission to find out whether there was any CIA involvement with the assassination of President Kennedy, and who did they put in really charge? Earl Warren wasn't really in charge, although he was the nominal head. It was a man named Alan Dulles, who, of course, is the founder of the Central Intelligence Agency. And lo and behold, first of all, they found that there was no conspiracy, other than it was just Lee Harvey Oswald, this lone known nut. And not only that, but they wouldn't allow several members of the Warren Commission, people like Hale Boggs and Senator Richard Russell, to write a minority report. They wanted to write a minority report. They weren't allowed to, because they didn't believe in the conclusions of the Warren Commission. Neither would anybody else who ever had the opportunity to really look into it. We're going to have to take a break. Would you mind hanging up? I'm going to have my producer call you back. Maybe we can get just a little bit better line, okay?
Sure.
Okay, fine. And so, Kyle, would you go ahead and call Michael Springman back here? And, of course, that just gives us a chance to talk a little bit about some of the other products we have here at Radio Liberty. And certainly one of them is the Miracle 2 soap products. And we've been very, very happy with these, and we've used them for at least 6 months on our own before we would offer them to our listeners. And we don't make any medical claims for them, but I will tell you, many of the people who've used them seem to think that it's helped their rashes and other problems that they've had. And all we can do is suggest that you give it a try and see if it will help you. And you can find out about the Miracle 2 soap products by giving us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-5-HIV, WAR. And if you'd like to get a pamphlet, if you'd like to get we sent the pamphlet out free of charge along with an audio tape, and you can hear the gentleman who actually designed the product. And I don't know, his story is a little strange, I'll have to admit. And some people say, well, they don't believe his story, and it may very well not be true. I can't say, but I will tell you, we've been very, very pleased with the product, and many of our people who use the product have been very pleased with it, and so we continue carrying it, and we're very happy, and I will tell you that I use it on a regular basis, and I'm, let's put it this way, I'm very, very happy. And this is called Miracle 2, and if you'd like to know more, give us a call at 1-800-5-HIV, WARP. And then, of course, we want to mention some of our four-tape sets. We have a great new four-tape set called Satanism and Deliverance, and you'll really find it a fascinating, fascinating tape. And we have our four-tape set on the Office of Homeland Security, and we advise you to understand what the implications are of this new system that is going to, of course, have neighborhood watch systems all across America, watching for those wicked terrorists. And, of course, reporting anything suspicious that your neighbor does, or maybe anything suspicious that you do to the local FBI office. And then, of course, we're going to have video cameras every place watching you, and all in the name of Homeland Security. Well, you really ought to get the four-tape set on the Office of Homeland Security. If you'd like a free copy of my latest newsletter, which goes into the most draconian law I've ever heard of, it's called the Model Emergency Health Powers Act. Why, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. We'll be glad to send you a free copy of our newsletter, but call now.
Another of our fascinating four tape sets is entitled Concentration Camps, and it's four interviews with people talking about the move to establish concentration camps in the United States. Now, most people say that's foolish talk. We couldn't have that. And yet, if you listen to these tapes, you'll find out that those camps are a reality. They are being set up in case of civil disturbance. And, of course, the authority for the establishment of the concentration camps comes from the executive orders, which were actually put through during the time of the Reagan administration. For documentation of the location and the background to the formation of these camps, their establishment, and what may very well happen, or what they may be used for in the future, I suggest you call our 800 number, 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. That's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR for America. Our values, our future are under attack today.
Well, Dr. Stan back here, and our guest this afternoon is Michael Springman. That's Michael Springman, and of course, we're talking about the fact that he was a clerk. He was working in the Injeta, and he was, of course, told to allow people to come to this country, and later he learned that this had to do with, of course, bringing the terrorists in here to the United States for training. Now, if you're out there in the listening audience and you'd like to talk to him, our telephone number is 464-8295 or out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 464-8295 or 1-888-24-LIBERTY. And, Michael, then, of course, you eventually lost your job. About when was that? What year was that?
It was 1992.
And, of course, then you came back to the United States, and what are you doing now?
Well, I'm working as an attorney. I do a little bit of immigration law, employment law, and some national security law.
Well, are you glad to be out of Saudi Arabia and out of the State Department?
Well, people ask me that, and I tell them that I miss being a tourist and getting paid for it. The job was always interesting, but the people I had to deal with in the State Department were becoming increasingly difficult to deal with.
Well, do you think, of course, that this is really a problem, that a lot of people in government compromise their principles because they know if they don't violate what they're supposed to do, they're going to lose their job, they're going to get into trouble, and they'll make
their
life miserable for them?
Yeah, they have no ethics, they have no morals.
Right.
And they don't believe that the laws of God or man control what they do.
Right. Well, of course, the tragedy is that most Americans don't understand. We brought the terrorists into this country.
Mm-hmm.
We brought in the terrorists for training. We brought them in to raise funds and actually to recruit other terrorists. In fact, in 1995, and anybody who questions this, we have the article out of the New York Times. We'll be glad to send you a copy if you give us a call and ask for it. There was a man named Dr. Al-Zawahiri. He was a pediatrician, an Egyptian, who had actually been involved in the murder of Anwar Sadat. And he fled the country. He actually then, of course, was living in Europe. And he was tried and convicted in absentia in Egypt. The Egyptian government wanted him extradited. He had been involved in the murder of their leader. And none of the countries, Switzerland or none of the other countries in Europe, would send him back again. Well, that's sort of strange. And then in 1995, Dr. Al-Zawahiri was given a visa to come to America. Now, this man's a known terrorist. He's a known terrorist leader. He's, convicted of murder and wanted for murder by the Egyptian government. And he's allowed to tour the United States, raising funds, recruiting terrorists, buying satellite equipment for his boss, Osama bin Laden, the wicked Osama bin Laden. And then allowed to leave this country and go back to Switzerland. What's wrong with this scenario? And I think that every American should ask those questions. Don't be swept along by the media. Don't be swept along because they're trying to get you attention focused on the wrong issues. And the Democrats are attacking the Republicans. The Republicans are attacking the Democrats. They're playing games with your mind. Well, we've got Fred calling in from Salinas. And again, our telephone number, 464-8295 or 1-888-24-LIBERTY, if you'd like to talk to Michael, because he's been on the front lines of this battle. Fred, do you have a question or comment?
Yes, I'd like to ask Michael, in his time over in the Arab states, had he ever heard any whispers of a white slave trade in that area?
Did you ever hear any whispers of white slave trading over there?
No, not really. The thing that occupied a lot of people's attention was what the Saudis did with their maids and their nurses. They would generally import somebody to serve as a nanny for their children, for example. They would be locked up in the house, and they would work 7 days a week, always on call, and would never be let out, and would be used in many instances as sex objects for the Saudi men in the household.
Now, isn't that against their Wahhabi religion? It's a very, very strict moral religion.
Sure. And on the few occasions when these people did manage to escape from the house, they had no idea where they were and had difficulty finding their way to any kind of sanctuary.
All right. And so this was a problem. So that really isn't white slavery, but certainly it is a form of slavery. And, you know, one of the other things that always bothered me, Fred, was that Idi Amin. Now, Idi Amin was a cannibal, and I have a book written by his minister of health when he was the dictator of Uganda. And talking about how he would go in when he'd have his enemies captured and executed, and then he'd go in there and spend time with them. He'd come out licking the blood off of his fingers. I mean, this man's living in palatial splendor in Saudi Arabia, and where is the International Criminal Court when you need them?
I know I had heard some whispers of people being spirited away out of this country and ending up in Saudi Arabia, and that's the last you ever see of them. I was just kind of wondering if...
Well, it may happen, but at least apparently Michael had never heard of that.
Yeah, right. And you know, there is also the issue of American women who would marry a Saudi and would go to live in Saudi Arabia and find that the rules of the game were totally different, and that they needed their husband's permission to travel, they needed their husband's permission to leave the country, and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
So that, you know, once they go in there, the silk curtain comes down.
Right, and of course there was an instance recently, apparently it was in England, where a woman had married a Saudi, and of course she was over there with her husband, and she couldn't stand anymore, so they took their son and fled to England, and he came over and kidnapped the son, took him back to Saudi Arabia, and of course the Saudi law says that she has no rights, the son belongs to the husband, and that's where the son is going to remain, and there's just nothing in the world that the wife can do about it.
Thank you.
Okay, thanks very much, Fred. Our telephone number again, 464-8295 or 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Well, you know, we heard a lot just before we went to war in Afghanistan about the terrible way that the Afghan women were treated. And they always had to be covered up. Of course, they had this sort of burqa where you would only see their eyes. But, of course, the terrible treatment of women. But what about treatment of women in Saudi Arabia? Are women treated well there? Do they have equal rights? Are they required to be veiled at all times?
Well, the requirement is more on the basis of what the husband wants done in his family. It isn't so much a governmental regulation or a law. It was, always a little bit strange. I had a well-connected Saudi tell me that his 12-year-old daughter needed a chaperone to be driven across town by the family driver that they've had with the family for some 20 years because of the built-in idea that because she was over 12, he would automatically try and attack her, or that she would seduce him.
So they have very, very strict laws where they certainly don't leave girls and boys alone together.
Exactly. And then, of course, you had situations where you had the women who were covered head to toe in the black abaya and, you know, with gloves, and sometimes they would have a veil, and other times they would simply have a scarf over their head. But at the same time, they would always, you see a lot of the women with a shortened abaya hem length and a shortened set of sleeves, and underneath you could see the hot pink pantsuit.
Okay. Well, of course, now, what about American women over there? If they are traveling in the Saudi community, do they have to wear a veil? Can they drive themselves? Can they...
They can't drive. You know, if they're expatriates, they can't drive, period.
Could you drive?
Yeah, men could drive.
Oh, but women.
But women of any nationality, Saudi or otherwise, couldn't.
All right, fine. So even if you're a Saudi woman, you can't drive.
Exactly.
What about working? Could Saudi women work?
Yes and no. If they worked, they would have to work in all female sections or organizations. For example, if they worked in a bank, the bank would have the women workers in one room and the men workers in another room.
So women really are not treated too well in Saudi Arabia.
No.
But nobody's ever suggested we go to war. What about if a woman's caught in adultery in Saudi Arabia?
It's difficult to prove. I mean, you know, there is the law, the Sharia law, that says death by stoning. But to do that, you need four witnesses who catch her in the act.
Okay, so you don't. It's not something that is commonly carried out. What about the handling of people who steal things? What is the punishment for stealing?
It depends on the frequency and the, I guess, the value of the theft. And you know, it gets to the point where it's viewed as sufficiently serious, they'll remove the right hand.
Okay.
Generally, they do it surgically. Under anesthesia.
Oh, they do it surgically under anesthesia.
Yeah, but this, you know, this is a double punishment. One, they don't have a hand to use, and two, since the left hand is the toilet hand in a country that doesn't have toilet paper for the most part, you can't reach into the communal cook pot with your toilet hand.
I see. So
you're sort of out of society as well.
All right. So now, at one time, you know, I thought they just lopped it off with a big sword. When did they go to taking it off surgically?
I don't know.
More humanely.
Yeah.
What did you ever see the hands tacked up on the walls? I mean, I've heard this in years past, but they don't tack the hands up now anymore.
No, and they never. In the case of you know, capital punishment, they would never give a listing of who is going to get his head chopped off when.
Well, do they actually still chop off heads over there?
Oh yeah. Mm-hmm.
All right. So this is not necessarily the a society like our society at all.
Of course, at the same time, violent crime is very rare.
Right. Well, I think it is. I imagine not too many people are stealing when they know the punishment is going to be to remove their right hand.
Yeah.
So, I mean, of course, these were many of the things that we were very critical of the Taliban for, and with good reason. I mean, I think these are inhumane approaches. But nobody has ever made a suggestion that we should have gone to war with Saudi Arabia just because 15 of the 19 terrorists were Saudi Arabian citizens.
Mm-hmm.
What was the significance of that from your point of view? In other words, why would Saudi citizens more than anybody else seem to want to destroy America?
Well, if you want to, if it's opinion, and I got to admit, it's kind of a vague.
It's an opinion. That's your opinion is probably better than mine. At least you've been there.
Yeah. Well, Saudi Arabia is out of the mainstream of Islam. They have a very, very strict, very, very conservative, very, very reactionary form of Islam, based on an 18th century sect.
Wahhabism. They call it Wahhabism,
exactly.
Right?
Yeah.
And but why would all these, why would it be the Saudis that would come over? We're being told it was the Al-Qaeda that came over, but these weren't Al-Qaeda, these were Saudi citizens.
Mm-hmm.
So
whether they were members or not, I don't know, but you know, they see the Americans as profaning the Holy Land of Saudi Arabia with occupation forces, with women soldiers, and so forth.
And basically, this is a large part of it. The Crusaders, who are looked upon as the Crusaders, were occupying the Holy Land and defiling the land where Mecca and Medina are. Would that be a fair statement to make?
Mm-hmm.
All right, fine. Well, we're going to have to take another break here, and when we get back, of course, we'll welcome your calls at 464-8295 or 1-888-24-LIBERTY. But right now, of course, we want to remind our listeners that Radio Liberty is listener-supported. And if you're listening to us out across America, we hope that many of you will decide right now that you want to join the Radio Liberty family of supporters, because that's how we do what we do 5 hours a day. And incidentally, we have some excellent opportunities to go on several other networks, but quite frankly, we can't do it until we know that they're paid for ahead of time. Now, as you know, we're doing the American Christian Network up there in the Oregon area, and there's several other networks that are have made very, very good offers to us. But if you're out there in the listening audience and you'd like to help us get onto additional networks, We have one with 17 stations. We could do a Saturday program on ridiculously cheaply, but we need the money ahead of time. If you'd like to help us, our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927, 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. And we certainly want a six-month commitment, whatever you could offer, so that we'll know that we'll be able to pay for at least 6 months. And then, of course, we have several... we want you to, hopefully many of you want to join the Radio Liberty family of supporters, and for a suggested gift of at least $20 a month or more, you'll get our four best tapes of the month, you'll get our monthly newsletter, but more than that, you'll be helping us do what we do, and that is reach out across America, 5 hours every day, 2 hours on the weekends, six different networks every week, six different audiences, bringing people the news behind the news, the story behind the story, and the understanding of the fact that we're involved in a spiritual battle being played on a political, ideological, cultural, financial, economic battlefield. And if you agree and you'd like to become part of our team, the telephone number again to call, 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR, because America is under attack today.
A book that will really help you to understand the nature of the spiritual battle in which we're currently involved is Gary Kaw's book, The Demonic Roots of Globalism. Now, you may remember Gary Kaw's book, En Route to Global Occupation. His second book, The Demonic Roots of Globalism, goes into the very real spiritual forces, the dark and sinister spiritual forces, which have energized those people who are molding the world in which we live today. Going into the background of Masonry, Theosophy, and he actually quotes extensively from the writings of these people who have helped to mold the events of the 20th century. The Demonic Roots of Globalism by Gary Kaw will give you tremendous insight into the background of what's happening in America today. And unless you understand the spiritual forces at work, you really can't understand the unfolding of events. Call 1-800-5-HIV-WAR and ask for The Demonic Roots of Globalism by Gary Kaw.
Okay, well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. Our guest this afternoon is Michael Stringman. And Michael, of course, was stationed in Jeddah at the U.S. consulate there. And, of course, he was told in no uncertain terms that he should go along and get along. And, of course, what most Americans do not know is that in that period of time, we were bringing the people to America for training who now are the terrorists, the Al-Qaeda terrorists. And these people were brought here, but it didn't stop, you know, and when the Afghan war ended, we continued bringing these known terrorists into America. We were, in my opinion, helping to create the best enemies that money could buy. And as we pointed out earlier, why Dr. Al-Zawahiri was allowed to tour America in 1995. Those of you who have not yet either seen Stephen Emerson's video or read his excellent book, American Jihad, and we actually carry that book. We have not had any luck at all in getting copies of the video to get for you, but his book, American Jihad, tells the whole story. I mean, all during the 1990s, and I'm talking up until right before the attack, we were allowing the terrorists to come into this country, and we knew they were terrorists. In fact, he even quotes from the testimony of a loyal American Muslim who testified before the Senate Intelligence Committee that this violent form of Islam, this Islamic terrorist movement, which was plaguing Europe and was plaguing the Arab countries, was being financed in large part from the United States. So this was nothing that suddenly was new, that we suddenly found after September 11th. All along, this was being financed right here from the United States. And the fact that most people don't know that is a reflection on the degree of control that exists today over what the American people think. Well, Michael, looking back at your experience there, what's your take on it? I mean, do you think that this was a terrible, terrible mistake allowing these people to come in here and be trained in these various terrorist techniques and giving them the knowledge now that it potentially can be used against us?
Well, I think it's insanity. It was insanity then, and it's insanity now. I had thought that with my yelling and screaming about what was going on, my going to the Federal District Court in Washington and trying under the Freedom of Information Act to find the documents and what was really going on there, and was being repeatedly refused, had stopped all of this. And then when I read that 15 of the 19 people who allegedly Trade Center and the Pentagon.
You're going to have to speak just a little louder.
Oh, sorry. I essentially think it's insanity rather than a mistake. And I had thought that my repeated attempts to get to the bottom of what was going on and my repeated protests about it had ended it. However, when I read that 15 of the 19 terrorists had gotten their visas at Jeddah, I thought, my God, this is still going on. The agency's consulate, and believe me, when I was there, of some 15 to 20 people stationed there based in Washington, I knew of only three, including myself, who didn't work for any of the American intelligence
agencies. In other words, the people who were really doing this was the American intelligence agencies.
Exactly. They ran the consulate. They were three-quarters of the people at the consulate.
And, of course, then the intelligence agencies allowed these people to come to the United States.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, these are the terrorists who committed that horrible act, you know, on the September 11th. Now,
so it's apparently continuing, and for whatever reason, we'll never know because nobody will ever exercise oversight over the intelligence system.
Well, now, tell us a little bit about you. Come back to the United States, and you were trying to get the information under the Freedom of Information Act, and then
right.
were you trying to get this publicized so that people would know that we were bringing a terrorist into this country and people who had no business coming here?
Eventually that's what I was trying to do. Initially, I wanted to find out for myself what was going on, and then when I ran into the three sources who told me what was really happening, I said, well, you know, let's see if we can expand this and find out and maybe publicize it. Over the last 10 years, I've written and had published a couple of articles on the CIA and the State Department and how so they are so closely intertwined.
So this secret intelligence agency and our State Department really sort of work very closely together then?
Oh, yeah.
Well, now, have you any articles that would be available to the general public? Where were these articles published?
A lot of them were published in a magazine called Unclassified, which regrettably is no longer being published for want of funds. It was sponsored by the Association of National Security Alumni.
Right.
Which was essentially former intelligence officers and people like myself with outside knowledge.
Okay.
The most recent article that pretty much flat out says that the agency was bringing these people to America for terrorist training was published in Covert Action Quarterly in their winter 2001-2002 edition. That's number 71.
2001-2002, how can people get copies of that?
If they can find it on their newsstand, they can buy it, or they can go directly to the publisher, Covert Action Quarterly at 1500 Massachusetts Avenue Northwest, Suite 732, Washington, D.C., 20005.
Would you get that just once more?
Sure. Covert Action Quarterly, 1500 Massachusetts Avenue Northwest, Suite 732, Washington, D.C., 20005.
And that's Covert Action Quarterly.
Covert Action Quarterly.
All right, fine. And so, is this one of your articles, or is this
yes.
somebody else's article?
It was my article. Essentially, the title is The Hand That Rules the Visa Machine Rocks the World.
All right, fine. And so, it is your contention that people who work in Jeddah were primarily CIA, they were bringing in the potential terrorists, or somebody working in that consulate had to, in all probability, had to have authorized at least many of these people who attacked the World Trade Center, the Pentagon, authorized their coming to the United States. Now, if they said they wanted to come to the United States to learn to fly, was that a legitimate reason? Did they have to have money? What would have been your qualifications for these people if they wanted to come?
If somebody said, I want to take pilot training, I would have asked questions about, well, do you fly now? Do you fly in the future? Do you have a contract to be hired by Saudi or Middle East Airlines or Egypt Air or something? I would have asked some questions.
All right, fine. Well, do you think that there'd been any way to have avoided having these people coming into this country? I mean, here are obviously people who came here specifically to do us harm.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's in some ways, it's fairly easy to screen them out, like the case of the two Pakistanis who couldn't name the trade show or the city in which it was going to be held. Other people who might have had a legitimate reason to come to the States, like the Iranian with the rug shop, I think would be difficult to do.
Although he was obviously working with the CIA.
Yeah, well, you know, I only knew that because the base chief told me.
All right, fine.
But in the case of some of these other people, it would have been difficult. Essentially, people came to the United States from Saudi Arabia to visit friends and family for business purposes, and once in a while to see the Grand Canyon or New York City or something like that.
All right. But now, of course, how long are they allowed to come? Are they allowed to come indefinitely? Are they allowed to come for a few weeks, a few months?
It depends on the person. It depends on the fraud pattern of their own country, and it depends on the judgment of the INS inspector at the port of entry. And I sometimes wonder if INS wasn't in on this as well, because if I, as a new consular officer, could see problems, surely an experienced inspector could have caught some of this, too. But by and large, the inspector talks to the guy at the port of entry and says, well, you know, you can stay for a month, you can stay for 6 months, in the case of, say, Europeans, for up to a year.
All right, of course, I think that the most fascinating part of this is that in 1995 and 1996, Congress enacted a law saying you have to the INS, you have to come up with a system to monitor the people that are in here, and so that, you know, the people go home when they're supposed to. And the INS refused to do it. I mean, so why do we even bother to have a Congress if the bureaucracy does whatever it wants to?
Well, I think you can blame both Congress and the bureaucracy. INS wasn't smart enough to ask for the tools it needed to do the job, and when it was given them, it didn't really manage them effectively. And Congress keeps turning around and goes hot and cold on immigration. Oh, yes, we need immigration because we want a diverse country and because we want cheap labor. And at the same time, they'll turn around and say, well, my God, Europeans will be a minority in America in 20 years. Maybe we should think about this some more.
Well, of course, there's always been a long-range plan to convert America from what we were. And that was basically a Christian homogeneous society into a multicultural society. That was the agenda. They did it. They stole America while nobody was watching. Well, do you have any parting thoughts for our listeners today?
Well, by and large, I think you've got to blame Congress, you've got to blame the executive branch, in particular the State Department, the CIA and INS, and the President. And ultimately, you've probably got to blame the news media for never investigating a lot of this stuff, who accept government explanations at face value. And you've got to blame the American voter for never putting his representatives in the government on the grill. They are quietly accepting whatever the government tells them, and you run into an awful lot of people, at least I do in Washington, who think the CIA is just another bureaucracy like Social Security or the Department of the Interior.
Well, of course, it has its own agenda, and anybody who's ever studied it knows that a lot of the drugs that come into America come in with organized help of some people very highly placed in the CIA. We're out of time, Michael. It's been a fascinating hour. Thank you so much for being with us.
Well, thank you for the privilege of talking to your listeners.
God bless you. Bye-bye.
All right, thank you. Bye-bye.
Okay, fine. And I hope you enjoyed that program. That was really an excellent, excellent program. An excellent overview of the things you're not going to get from Barbara Walters, Dan Rather, or Tom Brokaw. So this is the time we ask you to pray for America and pray for revival. Pray for our leaders and pray for our ministers. But please remember to pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and our protection. And so until Monday, and we will be doing a program Monday afternoon, why this is Dr. Stan saying goodbye, and may the Lord be with you.